Taller Women, A Fable of Love and Loss, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation with the novelist Lawrence Nomoff. We'll talk about his new book, Taller Women, A Cautionary Tale. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated.
The Rewani tribe used to hang their women upside down from a tower for 3 days. The Mogads, a nomadic people in what used to be known as Persia, used to punish the women who challenged established beliefs and authority by hanging them by their hair over the side of a camel and taking the camel far into the wilderness where the miscreant, the infidel, would have time to think about what she had done.
Novelist Lawrence Nomoff reading from his new book, Taller Women, A Cautionary Tale. Taller Women is a combination of fable, allegory, and what Nomoff calls superrealism that describes the tragicomedy of the way men and women treat one another. The action of the novel revolves around Monroe Hopkins, an emergency room doctor who can't seem to find a woman of just the right emotional height to fit his needs and demands. Monroe's treatment of the women in his life, including his ex-wife Katie, Lydia, to whom he's married during the course of the book, and Ronnie, a teenager he takes up with, amounts to both instruction and warning. I asked Lawrence Nomoff to describe how he creates characters like Monroe Hopkins and the interplay between his own experience and the lives of his fictional creations.
Well, that's interesting because I think I have been accused of possibly being my leading character, Monroe, in this book. And Monroe was a man who cannot find the right size woman. I mean, his first wife was eventually a taller woman, a stronger, more independent woman, and so he had to leave her. And then he moves downward, I suppose you could say, and takes up with Lydia, who is a working-class woman, and he thinks subconsciously, of course all this is not on a conscious level, he thinks that Lydia is probably the right size woman for him. She's not as educated as he is. and then that doesn't work because she gets to become demanding, and so then he leaves Lydia and moves downward to a little feral creature who seems not to have been raised by people but by wolves, and her name is Ronnie, and she's a teenager, and she is so fascinated by this older man who seems to know everything that he thinks possibly this is the right size woman. And so when people accuse me of being Monroe, I have to say, well, I may have been Monroe at one time in my life. Or all of us, all men, may be Monroe on the worst day of our lives, or on the worst day each year of our lives. We all may be Monroe, but I myself am also all the female characters in the book as well. So I'm all the characters. And at my worst, I am Monroe on my worst day.
Where does the idea of size come from? That is to say, smaller women, taller men, people who fit, as it were.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm speaking metaphorically always when I say taller women, taller men. And that, it just comes from the fact that originally, as I wrote the book, one of the early scenes I wrote was a scene with Monroe, who's an emergency room doctor, who's the kind of doctor who doesn't really connect to people, but he can certainly fix a body if there's something wrong with it. Right. Monroe and one of his colleagues were talking. And as they began talking, which is as I began writing this, this is happening at the same time. I'm not thinking where this scene is going to go yet. But as they begin talking, Monroe, to my surprise as the writer, says, "Have you noticed women are taller than they used to be?" And the other doctor says, "No." And then they go on and they talk about it. And then Monroe, to my surprise as a writer, because this was not planned, says, "You know, I think women are taller than they used to be." And the other doctor says, "No, I don't think they're taller, but I think they're happier." And then Monroe pauses and he says, "You know, there's something depressing about a happy woman." And then the other doctor says, "I don't get it." And then the doctor does get it and he says, "Ah, taller, happier women. And where does that leave us? So early on in the writing, the character himself gave me this idea for size by making a metaphorical comparison to women of the past and women of the future by calling them taller women.
How do you invent the dialogue, the wonderful dialogue that you have in this book, Lawrence? I mean, it is convincing on the one side. I, for one, found it very convincing, and yet I found it, as it were, the dialogue of a fabulist, somebody who's interested in allegory as much as the way real people talk.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are both things going on. There is actual dialogue, but then the dialogue does go beyond what's being talked about and does allude to things that are either going to happen or might happen or could never happen but seem like they should happen or have a reality of their own that you'd never see in the daily life that would have the meaning of a fable to you. And
this is what you call super reality.
Well, the super reality, I call this book super reality because of what Faye Weldon said when she read the book, and I admire Faye Weldon, the British writer, a lot. And
go ahead, yeah, read us that passage. Tell us what she said about your book.
I'd like to, because I thought this was interesting. This was early on. We sent this book. We didn't have Faye Weldon's address, and we sent a galley to essentially Faye Weldon, England, and it got to her.
Congratulations.
I know. It was wonderful. And she didn't know me from a hole in the wall, and she got the galley, and she said, Nomov creates a new genre. Call it, if you like, the new male fiction of feeling, end of the century division. He is so funny, so clever, so disturbing, so unputdownable about men and women. He seems in Taller Women to be summing up the fictional achievements of the last 30 years. His characters move in a nightmarish world. Well, hasn't it so become? Yet run, jump, suffer, respond so vividly, they quite give us hope for the next millennium, fictional and otherwise. So,
Do you think of yourself as a therapist, therefore? I mean, are you some sort of a... I mean, novelists do many things.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the categories that you create for yourself.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what I think a novel does, and this is sort of a paraphrase of something Norman Mailer says, and I'll tell you why I decided that Faye Weldon, when she said I created a new genre, was really referring to what I call superrealism. But a novel, I think Norman Mailer said something similar to this. A novel is supposed to correct a perverse situation or call attention to a perverse situation or illuminate a perverse situation in our life or in the world or in the culture, or a novel is supposed to provide a vision of wonder and hope and innocence. And Taller Women does both of these things.
You move back and forth between those.
I go back,
those.
Exactly.
Let's tick off some of these incredible and yet at the same time very credible incidents that occur in your book. You have a woman who gets hung by her hair. Isn't there something like that in the Bible? Who is it? Absalom, I think. Something like that happens. And you become something of an anthropologist, as it were, about the relationships of modern men and women.
Mm-hmm. I say, when and that's poor Martha, who has chosen this ex-convict for her love of her life, and she couldn't have made a worse mistake. I say, when Martha's friends end up having gone a little too far, and I say that ironically, and take her out on the balcony and tie her hair around a rail and hang her and leave her there, I say that this woman, this Martha, this woman who could represent lots of women for whom wantonness has been punished or would be punished, this woman became a symbol for everyone to see that if you go too far, if you go against the beliefs of the people in charge, the high priests or the priests of the culture, or the beliefs of the man who is, quote, in charge of you at the time, to whom you have given charge, then you will be hung out for everyone to see as a symbol of what will happen to women.
You got another incident in the book where Monroe, the lead character, takes, is it Lydia, and stuffs her down inside of a tire. They're on a shopping expedition.
Mm-hmm.
What in the world inspired that kind of incident?
Well, actually what happens is Lydia is sitting on a stack of tires. The tires are stacked flat, so it looks like a very tall donut or whatever. And and Monroe is talking to her, and suddenly he just loses it and shoves her by the shoulder down into these tires so that she falls all the way to the bottom, and that all you can see of her are her hands and her feet sticking up, and she is bound in there. She is captured. And that came to me because I was at a tire store once buying tires, and I saw a child sitting on a stack of tires and looked away and then looked back, and the child had fallen down into the tires.
Now,
Lawrence, the poor little child.
Let me stop you for a moment. Are we supposed to laugh at this? I mean, this is an awful thing that this man does to this
woman. I know.
Woman.
Well, I'm laughing at the child. I wouldn't dare laugh at Monroe shoving the woman down into it. The reader can laugh at that if he or she wants to. But when I look back, the poor child was down in the tires and was tied up and was bound. And I'll tell you how that's funny. I'll tell you how that scene is funny in the book. This is how that scene can be funny. It may be funny. I'll have to ask you, or I'll have to ask the reader if it's funny. This is the way that these things are funny. There was a Texas state senator who in 1989 said this, and I don't know if this is funny or not. This might be funny, it might not. The Texas state senator said, and I could give his name, but I won't. He said, "Do you know why God created women?" And his answer was, "Because sheep can't type." Now, is that funny? I'm not sure. Probably not. Probably it's pretty mean. But there are people out there probably now smiling at having heard that, or they're smiling inside, or they're thinking something. They're maybe reacting to the cleverness of it. So I don't know how you place those kind of statements in a cultural context as to whether they are funny or not.
You also have an incident in this book, Taller Women, seemingly out of nowhere, a man and a woman appear on the street, and the woman is on a leash.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you taking it too far? Are you hoping that the reader's going to buy this?
Mm-hmm.
In what spirit do you offer this, mm-hmm. this incident of misogyny?
Yeah, I offer that in the spirit of the way I wrote it, which is that I write it with such irony that you know that I am appalled by it, but that I know that metaphorically in some way a man would love to have a woman on a leash, just like metaphorically in some way a woman would like at some point to have her man on a leash. And so I say in that passage, the man walked down the street with the woman. He tied her to the rail as he went inside to get his chicken. The woman did not look unhappy. After all, it wasn't as if he never took her anywhere. See?
Well, so that's wicked.
Wicked funny.
Yeah.
Wicked funny, and the book is full of wicked funny.
The book is also full of some very tender moments, some wonderfully emotional moments that are not hokey.
Thank you.
And not maudlin. I want to refer to one of those now. What I'm thinking of is a passage here that reminded me of the wonderful James Agee's Death in the Family.
Mm-hmm.
Will you read this to me? Here is a very tender moment that mm-hmm. exists between parents and children.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. I will read that because it's one of my favorite. Something happens when grown-ups talk to children. What happens is clear when the grown-ups are your parents. Blood rushes from one to the other as if the umbilical were still attached. You may be sitting in chairs on the lawn, under the shade of an old tree that might have sheltered your mother, when she sat near her mother, and both felt the same, as you now did as you talked. Those are rich times, they are rare times. When it works, so much can be learned, and the supplication of being alone, or being different, or being hated, or being unloved, or confused, or angry, all diminished in those times when the grown-ups talk to their children. Sometimes in the morning the children awaken, and in their enthusiasm they would fly down the halls. They'd leap on their parents' bed. It might have been summer when this happened. They were home from school. Father left for work and mother remained with them. Mother knowing what was in her children and feeling it exactly the same in herself made a special event of the day. She took them for walks and picnics and lazy hours under the trees. There she told them what she had been like as a child. She told them about her brothers and sisters and what her parents had been like, and about the times she had gotten into trouble, and the things they had done to each other, and the things she, like them, feared. She told them how she met their father, how their lives had come to be what they were today. In those moments, in the cool, subdued shadows, each person existed in silhouette. the children began to understand the world and themselves and these people who were their parents and what it was that happened that brought you through your life.
This is Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You're listening to a conversation with the novelist Lawrence Nomoff. We're talking about his new book, Taller Women, A Cautionary Tale, recently published by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. You are talking here, Lawrence, about the shaping of families, about the way our patterns, individual and social, create themselves. Mm-hmm. Do you feel a special responsibility as you create language like this, a responsibility to yourself, to the culture that you're a part of?
Yes, it doesn't happen consciously while you're writing. It happens as a result of who you are and how the book is going and what you are intending to say. And when one is writing a book, these lyrical moments of truth that happen, that you go back and polish and make richer, are the things that mean the most, I think, to me when I'm writing.
Now, I say this with a straight face, Lawrence. I mean, we've had a lot of talk in our culture lately about something called family values. Mm-hmm. That is to say, the way families work and function, mm-hmm. or become dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. That seems to occupy a lot of the weight and the burden, the message of this book, Taller Women. Am mm-hmm. I right?
It's true. I used the dysfunctional family of Ronnie and her two unusual older parents, who she claims are not her mother and father, but of course are. I used that to put Ronnie outside of convention, so that she could be a person who would have the vision and the innocence to be different from what someone else who had had a good and normal life would be, who might walk into the world as trusting as Ronnie, but would not have the toughness to persist.
What's going to happen to Ronnie and Monroe as they, as it were, disappear over the horizon on the Blue Ridge Parkway at the end of your book?
Well, I call that last section Katie Women, and I call it Katie Women because as Katie, who comes into the book at the end, she was Monroe's first wife, and they haven't seen each other for many years. As she comes into the book at the end, and she's the only first-person narrative in the book, she comes in the book as the voice of wisdom and the voice of understanding, and she explains why this man, this Monroe, is like he is. And she sees little Ronnie, and she feels something for Ronnie.
Oh, she's very sympathetic, very compassionate.
Yes, there's a beautiful...
Not what you would expect.
True.
Up to that moment in the novel.
Right. And there's this beautiful scene where they meet, and they meet on the common ground of being women, of being sisters, of being two women who this man has loved. And I call that section, including Ronnie, Katie Women, because Ronnie is going to be, later in her life, as strong as Katie is now.
Does this mean that you're optimistic about the future of what we call marriage, the relationship? What is the term that we should mm-hmm. use here?
Well, probably the future. I don't know about the future of marriage, because if it was originally based on something, you know, maybe economic needs and so forth and so on, and it was guided and controlled by certain rules that most everyone in the culture went by and believed in, and now those rules have all been broken and no one knows. I don't know what, you know, the convention of marriage will hold for the future, but I think that the conventions of romance and love and innocence and sweetness will always be there, and I think that that's what Ronnie is in the book for. Ronnie is to show that no matter what happens to you, there will always be the moments in your life of sweetness and romance and beauty.
What about Monroe himself? I mean, after all, he is a physician. This is a man to whom we turn as a figure of authority and harmony and healing in our culture. And yet this guy is, well, he is a doctor and he is a healer, but maybe not, strictly speaking, on an emotional level. Is he a hero or is he a villain?
Monroe is an anti-hero, and that's what some people have had trouble with the book, because most heroes nowadays are not anti-heroes, but Monroe is an anti-hero, and what will happen to him in the future is he'll probably go on being the same as he always has been, because he's past the point of changing himself. What he does in his life instead of changing himself is to change women and just move on, but he is an anti-hero.
He sees a light from his bedroom window. He's looking out. I thought of Scott Fitzgerald. You told me not to think about Fitzgerald, but what?
Well, the light that he sees looking out his window, which he does look out from this upstairs window and sees through the woods, a warm and yellow light, the kind of light you might see in a house that was darkened except for an old lamp that was on near a window. That light represents to Monroe the warmth and safety of home and the life that he really never can get for himself. And so he stares out this window looking at that light and wondering where that light is and what it means and why he has never seen that house before in the daytime, when there at night is that light that he can sometimes see turned on.
This is the kind of diminishing dream of domesticity that we have in our country. Lawrence, let me get personal for a moment.
Sure.
Are you a happy or an unhappy person? What does it take to create situations and characters such as you have done in Taller Women?
I would say I'm happy. I'm as happy as a thinking and enlightened person can be. And I often think it might be better to think less and know less. But I'm quite happy every day, and I wake up every day ready to go and enthusiastic and wondering what the day will bring, and chomping at the bit to get back to my typewriter and write. And what it takes to write a book like Taller Women is having gone beyond all the things you are dealing with in Taller Women. You can't really write a book if you're depressed and happy no matter what the book is about. I know that. From hearing from other writers, I know that to write a novel and to pull everything together and to deal with things that are tough and true and wild and funny and bizarre, as well as disturbing.
But you've done it in this book.
that you have to be in a state of understanding and happiness, and you have to be calm. You have to be calm enough and reflective enough and honest enough and strong enough to sit there day after day and have all this stuff come up and come out on the page and make a shape out of it. You have to be that way, or you can't do it. You cannot be restless and crazy and depressed, or nothing will happen.
Lawrence Nomoff, a footnote to our conversation. What does it mean to you to be a Southern writer? Is that a particular blessing or curse?
It's both. Since I don't write in the traditional, in the Southern tradition of rural families or white trash families and dialect, I'm outside of that stream of writing. I'm not a member of the Algonquin group of writers, but I do write in the Southern intellectual tradition, I suppose. Probably something like Walker Percy, and Walker Percy's had a great effect on me, and I admired him as a human being. And when I was with my publisher before this book was Farrar, Straus & Giroux, which is Walker Percy's longtime house, and I tried to have them arrange a meeting for me with Walker Percy, but he died. He was sick for a long time, and he died recently before that could happen. But he has had a great effect on me and great influence on me as a writer and as a person. I know something about how he lived, and that he was an honorable man and a man who knew his duty and responsibility both on a personal level and as a writer. Uh-huh. And I admire that and would be very happy if I could live up to just a little bit of it. So in that kind of Southern tradition, I am a Southern writer.
Tell me what you're working on now.
I'm working on a new book, which is a novel, but I call it a novelism. And I had two titles for it. The first title was Business and Pleasure, a Novelism. Novelism is my word. And the second title that I have for it at the moment is Thank You for Not Killing Me. And this is a novel.
Oh, my goodness.
This will be my first novel that where innocence and goodness prevail and defeat evil and coldness clearly. They clearly prevail. Innocence and goodness clearly prevail
Stephen,
in this book.
Stephen King, huh?
Yes, and they clearly win. And because it is so clearly a happy, happy novel all the way from beginning to the end, not unrealistically happy. I mean, there are some evil characters, but they get their due, and they get their due in some very surprising ways. But because goodness and happiness and innocence and wonder and hope and all of those things survive and prevail and dominate at the end, by the end of the book so much, I would have to say the book must be a fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Would I have to say that?
I'll leave that to you.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I call it a novelism now, so novelism could include a fantasy.
Well, we'll come back to that, and you have a standing invitation when that book comes out. We'll do another Soundings together.
Okay, good.
Lawrence Nomoff, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. Your wonderful new book here is Taller Women, A Cautionary Tale. The publisher is Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. Thanks for coming by the National Humanities Center. Good luck in your work.
Thank you very much.
This is Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guest was Lawrence Nomoff. His new book, Taller Women, A Cautionary Tale, was recently published by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. Lawrence Nomoff is also the author of two other novels, The Night of the Weeping Women and Rudy Kazuti. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. This week, it's program number 637. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. That's program number 637, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. The center welcomes your comments and suggestions. Next week, Computers and Culture. Listen for Tom Johnson of San Francisco State University and Stephen Levy, a scientific journalist who writes for Macworld magazine. Tom Johnson will talk about the digital revolution, computers, and privacy. Stephen Levy will discuss his new book, Artificial Life. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Women, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation with Lawrence Nomoff. His new book is Taller Women, subtitled A Cautionary Tale. Are women getting taller? Are they happier? Some answers and insights from Lawrence Nomoff in Taller Women, a modern fable of romantic love and loss. This week on Soundings.